Churchill came on. Now, Churchill had been everybody's god, 1940, 41, 42, 43, etc. And for the first time, the people in the audience started to boo. They thought, well, what are these people booing for Churchill? You know, he's just more or less won the war. But they're booing because they don't want him to be Prime Minister.
I'm Anne Dibben.
I'm Bev Evans, and this is Unexpected Turns.
The show where we get to delve into the lives of some pretty remarkable people. None more so, in my opinion, than my dad, who's always told me stories about his time as a child, and today I'm lucky enough to have persuaded him to let me record some.
But anyway, I'll curl myself up.
Right.
Now, what do you want to know?
Any of your early memories, really, before the war, when the war started?
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about when I grew up, what things I remember about growing up. I mean, I started off in Newcastle and didn't know anything about that because we moved when I was about 3 or 4 to Washington. And we lived in this rented, I think it was a rented house anyway, nice house. And all I can remember from that area is we lived in a sort of row of these houses. I think they were sort of semi-detached. And I had a bike, a cycle,
cool.
Tricycle, but the seat didn't work. It was broken. Now, when it was broken, who broke it, I've no idea. I just remember the way I used to cycle was I'd sit on the back of the cycle where the two wheels are, you know, on the back. And of course, that had a triangle like that.
That's right.
So yeah. I sat on the triangle and I used to cycle all the way up the road at the back because we looked out onto fields and things, so it was just the one road. I used to cycle up there. Probably wasn't very far at all because I mean, I'm talking when I'm 4 or 5. I don't think I was even 5. Used to cycle up there with the little feet going round. And then at the top, I always got a bit worried because the people at the top in a detached house, and I think he was, he had his own business as a barber, and they had a nice big Alsatian.
He
cycled very carefully around there. And then on the other side, of course, you came out and you came down along the pavement back, and I used to cycle around there. That's all I remember about that. And then when Alan was very ill and they were going to do this appendicitis thing.
So you'd still be 5 then?
Oh, still 4 or 5, definitely.
Yeah.
Because they thought Alan was going to die. I mean, it must have been dreadful for my mother and father because the operation was going to be held. And the doctor said, well, I can't, you know, say anything at all. Just walk around the garden and then come back to see us and we'll know then how the operation has gone, good or bad. So they went round, of course, it was good. And I'm told this is, I'm pretty sure it's 37 or 38, might have been 38. I mean, Alan was born in 35, sorry. And they tried to think of what they would call the house when we moved into Allendale. And it was called Allendale because after him getting out of the hospital. They were going to call it Alan Home, but they thought that didn't rhyme, so it became Allendale.
You'd already planned that move before Alan got ill?
Oh, definitely. The house that was Allendale, we were renting, I think it was rented anyway, I don't know, was in another part of Washington.
Got it.
On the outside border of Washington. And then they developed this block of houses, well, not a block, series of houses, in at Village Lane. I mean, they started from the graveyard, which is a great place to start a row of houses. But they did that. It probably was about, you know, quite a few yards, but I don't know whether it would be allowed now anyway. And then we lived up near the top end of it. So we were well away from him. Mm. And that's what I remember. And I remember nothing else. I just remember this is sort of history that I was told later. Because as a, you know, 4 or 5 year old, you don't know these things. You just go from place to place. And then the war broke out, as they say. But you know, when you're six, was I six when it broke
out? Yeah, you would have been six. 1939, you would have been six.
Just on six.
And do you remember being told that we were at war?
No. The first sort of war memorial, war thing I can think about, you know, where it's actually the war and nothing else, was when we listened to the radio, and I remember my father saying, it's going to be bad news, because Churchill was going to make an announcement. I think they've lost Singapore. And my father was, of course, right. Singapore surrendered. It wasn't supposed to surrender, but it did. And that's the first sort of thing.
And that was 19...
I'd have to look the date up. I wouldn't swear it was 1940. It's after Pearl Harbor, which was 41. But I do know that's what my father said.
It's going to be bad.
I think it might have been 42. But you get that on your... Just have a look at on your machine. Just put Singapore down, fall of Singapore, see what comes up.
Yeah, you were right, 1942.
Yeah, I thought it was. So that's the first actual war thing that I remember on the news, if you like. I mean, by then, of course, 42, how old would I be in 42? I'd be nine. You know, by the time I was nine, I knew what an air raid shelter was, because it was a big air raid shelter in the school grounds. A big, you know, long one. And every now and then, you know, they'd do a practice. And I remember Miss Joan's great story, because she was older than me, so she was further upper class. And they had this very strict teacher, and they had some needlework to do. And if they didn't get the needlework done, it was homeworks, if you like, they used to be in trouble. And Joan had left her needlework at home, or whatever she'd done. And so the class was saying, oh dear, you know, it'll be terrible, it'll be terrible. She'll catch you out, you know, you'll be in real trouble. And, believe it or not, the air raid siren rang. So we all had to scuttle to the shelter, including Joan. And all the children said, oh, next time if I get something, say a prayer for me and I'll not get caught. So that, I remember that about her. But the other bits and pieces that you remember were mainly the food. We did have school meals. Now, I don't know when they started, probably after the war started. Because I remember we went for one meal and they had a lot of beetroot. Because the food was no real food at all. And the food was pretty grotty. Not that I noticed it, because I just ate. ate all this beetroot. And said, oh, you're eating a lot of beetroot. And I said, oh, yeah. And I never ate beetroot again, because it put me off for good. I didn't go back to it. But, you know, that sort of daft stories that you get when you're, as I say, 7, 8. That's the sort of age I remember that. Again, I remember my father, and I think what they did it was, they did it together. The neighbours came together, the men, and each dug each other's trench and put the Anderson shelter in it. So we had an Anderson shelter, you know, going down 2 or 3 steps, and then you got into it and you had seating around the sides. And of course, if it was going to be a big air raid, you were supposed to sleep there. And I remember we had wooden planks and with carpet. They didn't have carpets. We had blankets rolled up, and you rolled up in the blankets and you stayed there. Your parents were there with you. My mother would be with us and my father would be going out to see what was happening. But nobody else was allowed to go out in the rest of the family.
Because he was too old to fight, wasn't he?
What they did, they called up the younger men first, and he, by 1940, he was 41.
Yeah.
So, of course, he'd been in the First World War.
Yeah.
But he was in the Dad's Army, the Home Guard. And I always remember the story about, I don't know what they were doing now, something possibly, I mean, talking 1942, 43, so my vague memory of it, they were doing something about testing aeroplanes. Now, we didn't know that. They were testing, not aeroplanes, but stuff from aeroplanes. And it was this silver thing, and I think it was something to do with radar, to see where you could hear radar from an aircraft. Don't know why.
And he was involved with that as the Home Guard?
As a Home Guard. The three of them were supposed to be looking out after it. And they had one rifle between them. And the first one, because there were hardly any rifles, the first Home Guard were trained with people walking around with sticks.
Yeah.
I know that from history, not from watching it. But they had the one rifle. And I remember the three of them standing around the fence talking about it. And they had the gun. And Squibby, he looked after the gun. And so he came out with the gun. And it was my father and the bloke next door. And they were saying, well, we don't know what it is now, and what we'll do about the bullet. Squibby, my father, because it didn't call him Squibby, but it was Squibby, my father, and Bramhall.
Bramhall. So where did he get the name Squibby from?
His name was Squib.
Squib.
So they called, but you didn't call that, you didn't call that to his face or anything like that, you know. He was Mr. Squib.
Got it.
And they were standing there, and he had the gun, and they said, all right, you've got the guns, you look after it. And he said, oh no, Jim, you're the best shot. You're the best. And they're passing it around. And of course, Bramhall, said, no, doing with me. I'm in the fire brigade. I've got this. He'd got a great big hammer, great big axe. But of course, this was all just rubbish that was coming down. But you could hear.
What do you mean rubbish? That it was stuff that silver bits they were testing to see if they showed on the radar.
Well, I don't know. It was never explained. Never explained. That's the only thing I could think of afterwards, after when I thought about it.
Got it.
So you had all that sort of stuff going on, just as you were growing up. I mean, I was growing from when the war started. I was just six. And I'm talking, you know, I was a seven-year-old, eight-year-old, nine-year-old when the war was going, 41, 42, 43. And, you know, you meet soldiers and things. One of my mother's brother was in the big army camp. There was a big army camp about 2 miles up the road. And he was there working on some, again, I think the development of radar. And he came once or twice down to see her. He wasn't stationed there for very long. And he came down to see her, and you know, we saw him there with a couple of his mates. And my mother made him some tea and things like that. And then, of course, the other thing that went on a lot of was the black market. You weren't supposed to do this, but everybody did it. Exchange the food that you were given. You know, because all food was rationed.
Yeah.
And you'd have so much for butter, so much for tea and all the rest of it. And we used to go down because Alan and I did it to this woman who lived not in Village Lane, in the street going up from Village Lane. And I think we gave her tea and she gave us butter, something like that.
That's right.
No money involved. Just swapping around what you wanted to teach. And that's the sort of thing that we did. And of course, every night you could hear guns going on because the guns were based, you know, the places that were flown over, bombed a lot, were Newcastle and Sunderland, Washington in between. Hardly any bombs were there. I think a few incendiary bombs were there. That was about it.
So why weren't any of you evacuated then?
Joan was evacuated.
Yeah.
The reason for that was it was thought that it wasn't a serious area. See, a place like Southampton would be bombed like mad all the time because all these planes had a limited life flying because I think some of the smaller planes could only fly for 20 minutes, say, before they had to go back because they were running out of fuel.
Mm.
And that meant that the bulk of England, the south of England, was hammered, and the key points like Newcastle and Sunderland, they were hammered, but the rest of the places, which is why they took a lot of children down to Devon and Cornwall.
Yeah.
All that sort of stuff went on.
So Joan was evacuated. Why then? Why was she evacuated when because you and Alan weren't?
Because that was the panic that came up first.
Got it.
To start with, they thought the Germans would bomb the country to pieces. And I think, I mean, this is just my speculation. I have no historical proof of it at all. But I do think there was everybody was being evacuated, especially in the south. And Joan had just started secondary school in Newcastle. And they took her out. But by the time I started in Newcastle, 2 years after Joan, the panic wasn't quite on. You see, I think I started in 1944 in Newcastle. And of course, by then, the bombing was concentrated on London and places like that still. And so I think they didn't do any evacuation.
Right.
And that, certainly, I was never evacuated. Joan was only evacuated for, I think, from starting school in September for 3 months, something like that. Mm-hmm. Then she came back and they went back to school as ordinary.
So were you scared with all these guns? You're saying every night you could hear all the guns. Were you all scared?
Oh, no, it didn't bother me.
Why do you think that was?
Of course, you could look out and you could see the sky. You could see, oh, that's a plane up there. You're not supposed to, but you did.
So you came out your Anderson shelter to have a look round and see what was going on?
Oh, yeah, and then you got shouted at if the bombing got too hard. And then you had to get out. But that was when I'd grown up a bit. I was, 9, 10, 11, something. Oh, I wasn't 11. Yeah, I was 11 when they were still having the Anderson shelter, but we weren't using it so much as from what I remember. I can't remember as an 11-year-old, well, going on 12, going into an Anderson shelter.
And going to school, you were all given, I remember you telling me about when you were all issued with your gas masks.
Oh, yeah. Well, you always had those. I can remember distinctly getting them because, as I say, my grandfather made these wonderful tin to hold the gas mask. And you just put it in there, and it sat there beside you. Until somebody accidentally knocked it over.
Because it made a nice rattle when it hit on the floor.
Oh, yeah. Woke the school up. But that, again, I think it stopped the mania for gas masks. Otherwise, everybody had to have a gas mask.
So they stopped probably in the last year or so, people stopped using them when you were about 11.
Well, they faded out. I may be wrong. I may be completely wrong. I mean, you're trying to remember something.
I know.
That
I can't remember all that.
80-odd years old, quite a few years ago, 70-odd years old. I'll get away.
I can't believe that you weren't scared. Like, that you just thought it was exciting and watching all these planes.
But you see, the problem with that is that, like everything else, it's what you like to remember. Now, I might have been terrified. I can't remember being terrified, but I might have been. But on the whole, I just scuttled into the air raid shelter when I was told and think, oh, that's it. The only definite incident I remember, because it surprised me, was when I was at school, this is when I was about 12, talking to one of the boys in the group with me. But I remember talking to him about the war. We were discussing the war, and I remember him saying, do you think we lose the war? Also, did you ever think we'd lose the war? And I said, no, I knew we'd win the war. And he was very surprised. He said, I always thought we might lose it. And that was when I was about 12, 13, but that's just me. That's my attitude about the war, because it didn't strike me ever that we would lose it. Never remember any thought of it, even when my father was saying, they've lost Singapore. But then, of course, when you're 8 or 9, Singapore doesn't mean a lot to you.
No. And so were there people in your street that you can remember going off to war?
Yes.
And did they survive? Did they not survive?
one of them didn't survive, up the road from me. Borland, he was called, and his wife was a school teacher, and he had a 10-year-old daughter, Jennifer, I think her name was. I think she was older than me, I can't remember. But anyway, I remember seeing him going down the road in his uniform, and then somebody said he'd been killed. But that was quite late in the war.
Mm.
So quite a few people, I mean, like two of my mother's brothers, the one who was in the army camp up the road, Wilfie, he survived the war. And another one, Willie, he went through the desert and all the rest of it. So did one of my father's cousins, who went all the way through the desert war and got a mention in dispatches and things like that. And he became, it was sad really, he was a teacher, and he taught first of all in the Glebe, which is one of the big schools in Washington. And then he took over and became headmaster of the what was then the secondary school, which of course later on became, changed the name to grammar school. It was for the people who passed the 11 plus.
Yeah.
He was running that.
Right.
And they had a house in Glebe Crescent, which was quite a smart area of Washington. And we used to go and walk down there to visit them on Sunday mornings. Not my father, but you know, just to get the children out of the way, really, give them something to do. What was sad about it was he retired at 65 and died at 66.
Oh, dear. Going back to the war, you said it was good those people survived. Do you remember the war ending? Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they had all sorts of parties for that. And one of the councillors who lived near us, well, he wasn't a councillor, as I've now discovered, he was a member of the council place. He was a workman, and it wasn't a workman. Oh dear, my God, no. He had some duty, some job in the county hall.
Yeah.
And that was their job. They were working for the council, and so they were a member of the council in that sense. And they organised a big bonfire to celebrate not the end of the war, but the end of the war in Europe.
Right.
And then he managed to get some petrol, which of course you couldn't have any petrol. So, you know, your cars were all limited. Very few people had any cars at all. And, you know, they did a sort of mock Guy Fawkes Hitler or something. And they set the thing on fire with all the local twigs, branches and all the rest of it they could find. And we just all went along there and cheered and threw stuff, you know, whatever rubbish we'd got that could go on the fire, and did things like that.
But that was before the war was officially finished. But you all knew by then you were going to win.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, the biggest celebration, I think, now, of course, historians might tell me I'm wrong, but of course you've got to describe what you remember.
Yeah.
Was definitely VE Day, the end of the war in Europe. Partly because you knew all these places and you knew them by heart. But the war in the Far East, you didn't know much about. Places like Singapore, oh yeah, Singapore's fallen, oh yeah. And then the fight in Burma, which went on forever.
Mm.
Whereas in Europe, you've got all the dramatic things, like the march on Paris, De Gaulle marches down Champs-Élysées, and, you know, this bit of Germany had been captured, that bit of Italy had surrendered, all that sort of stuff. Massive publicity for that.
And did you watch it at the cinema? Was it on the radio? How did you find out about all of this?
Oh, well, you knew it from the radio, and you also, when you went to the cinema, there was always the newsreel, and the newsreel showed you what was happening in the war. You know, you get newsreels of Vera Lynn singing to the troops in North Africa. All that sort of stuff was on in the cinema.
Hmm.
Anyway, I'm getting cold here, so I won't tell you anything else.
No, it was interesting.
Well, it's just what you remember. And what you remember is never perfect.
I can't remember anything about when I was that young. I don't think you've done very well to remember all of that.
Well, because you've had a more interesting life than I did. Well, I think that's true, you see. For example, if you looked for children that weren't born and bred in Washington, there were few and far between. My mother was known to quite a lot of the women as the woman from Newcastle, because everybody was from Washington. Very few people weren't Washingtonians, if you like it. Places were much more... I mean, that's a small village.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, 17,000 people spread over a huge area. It's 70,000 now.
Yeah. So you pretty much knew everybody in the village then, I suppose.
You knew most of the people in the village. I was always thought it was very sad. There was what they had a small block of houses, which were not very good, right, but very old-fashioned. This is not during the war. This is after the war. And this fella, something with his legs or something, he couldn't walk very well. And he used to sit on his doorstep or on a chair or something.
Yeah.
And he used to always wave and chat and say something to you as he went by. And then they developed the place, etc. And I came across him when I was doing something to do with the church. I was giving out leaflets or something at the far end of Washington. And it was a lovely place, looking straight out onto the fields. And he was sitting in the doorway. We sort of spoke, oh, you know, how are you settling in here? Oh, he said, it's not the same. He said, because, of course, they were all fields. And people walking past him were few and far between. Whereas where he'd been before, people were going down, walking into Washington, into the village part, where you went to Len Ward's, which was the equivalent of a co-op. Well, it wasn't a co-op at all. It was like, you know, that sort of stuff. So you bought your food there. You went along and you got your newspaper or stamps or whatever you want, that sort of thing. And so you were going up and down a constant trail. So you always had somebody to see and say something to.
Yeah.
But there, he said it was very boring, just sitting there.
So he'd been moved into a nice house rather than this scruffy house, but he just didn't have the company.
That's it, yeah. Well, I shouldn't say it's scruffy house, it might have been a good house, but it was small and they were developing that particular area or something, I don't know. But they might have thought they were moving him. Perhaps he was more handicapped later on, they're moving him somewhere where somebody would look after him, I don't know.
We'll hear more from you.
No, you won't. I think I talk too much, really, but I can't. Squat it down to about 5 minutes, and I might talk to him for another 5 minutes.
Well, if you've made it this far, you'll know I didn't squab it down to about 5 minutes. But my dad did ring me the next day just to tell me something he'd forgotten, but wanted mentioned about the end of the war.
After the war in Europe finished, they had a general election, even though the war in Japan was going on. Because there was a general election coming up, people were talking about the future. And, of course, the only entertainment we had all during the war was going to the cinema.
Yeah.
Everybody went to the cinema once or twice a week. Because it was cheap to get in, and it was, you know, you could watch, it was just a change. And I went to the cinema, probably with Alan, and the news came on, because there's news every bit of programme played. You know, you'd get the film, then you'd get the news. Uh-huh. You know, the British Army was advancing here, and this, that, and the other was happening. And, of course, with the general election, they put up some stuff about the general election. Of course, Churchill came on. Now, Churchill had been everybody's god, 1940, 41, 42, 43, etc. And for the first time, the people in the audience started to boo.
And
what are these people booing for Churchill? You know, he's just more or less won the war. But they're booing because they don't want him to be Prime Minister. And, of course, he was not elected as Prime Minister. Attlee took over and the Labour government took it. Moved in and got all the, you know, all the big reforms. Although, to be fair, it was the Tories. It was a collective government that did it. That got the 1944 Education Act, which set up secondary schools going into grammar schools and all that sort of stuff. It came as a shock to me, as an 11, 12-year-old, seeing the people boo Churchill after we'd been praising him all the way through the war.
Right.
That's just an odd sort of snippet, how things changed. You know, the year before, he was the great man leading Britain to freedom. And that, when the election came up, they turned against him. And he didn't get elected as Prime Minister. The Labour Party took over.
And why do you think that was? Why do you think they suddenly turned against him?
Because they thought he wasn't going to do enough for the ordinary people. And, of course, the Labour Party got in. Look what it did. It nationalised the coal mines with the 1944 Education Act. It changed education altogether.
Mm.
And there were all sorts of other bits and pieces that they did. And, of course, the National Health Service was started under the Labour government. They did all that, which is what people wanted them to do.
Right.
And, of course, they wanted to win the war, but they didn't think Churchill would move after the war in that direction. And so the coal mines were all nationalised. Before that, they were all owned by private people who could do anything they want. You know, say, right, we're going to charge you so much for coal, and to the workers, we're going to charge you so much for your job, you know, so much an hour you'll get or whatever. But they got better conditions and everything under the Labour government.
Mm.
During the war, it had been a coalition government. Attlee was the deputy prime minister in the war. Churchill was the prime minister. Then after the war in Germany was won, of course, it was a free election. And Attlee stood as a Labour leader, and Churchill as a Conservative, and Attlee won it. But that's, you know, history. I wouldn't put that in. I would just put it in how people's attitudes must have changed, because I was shocked as a 12-year-old to see people booing Churchill, our great hero.
I always love listening to my dad's stories and hope that you've enjoyed some of his memories of the World War. Bye. For those of you who've been listening to the show for a while, you'll know we've spoken to a couple of parents whose lives took an unexpected turn after the birth of their child. We all had a fantastic time celebrating my dad's 90th birthday last week, and there was definitely no beetroot on the menu. Till next time.
We spoke to Sarah and Emma, both of whom had children who were diagnosed with autism and had to struggle to get the best for their families. Next time, we're speaking to a budding musician, Michael. He describes himself as autistic and dyspraxic too, so it will be interesting to hear what he has to say.
It will, definitely. Well, thank you very much to our guest, my dad, today. I really look forward to talking to him again about some of his other memories. And I'm also obviously looking forward to hearing from Michael next time. So thank you, and thank you to you, our listeners,